Is it authentic? Is it really the right moment to be buying a work from this artist? Or should we wait for a couple of years when she's matured perhaps a little bit? Because this happens. You buy a work and then suddenly her best work is 5 years later. And you have this work that now looks less exciting than the Happy Museum who waited 5 years to buy a work.
My name is Lisa Zeitz, and today I have the pleasure to speak with Mark Mayer, former director of the National Gallery of Canada. Normally, we are in a sound studio in Berlin to record the podcast. Today, to all our listeners, you will maybe hear some background noise. We are here at the beautiful Belvedere Café on board the MS Europa 2 on our way to Vancouver. Weltkunst podcasts have been recorded in a former horse stable, in a gas station, in a museum turned, and in a gallery, but now for the first time ever on board the cruise ship MS Europa 2. I'm very excited. Dear Mark, when I ask you the question, was macht die Kunst? What is the art up to right now? What comes to your mind?
Oh, I'm going to sound like someone's grandfather. Art is up to no good right now, actually. I don't want to be too negative. As I got older and as I got more involved in art, I became more and more interested in the intellectual, the philosophical side of art. What Schelling, the German idealist philosopher, would say, the thinking instrument that art is for philosophy. And I'm seeing less and less and less of that. I'm seeing more figuration, and figuration that I find a little bit boring and not very nostalgic. I mean, it's illustration. I'm seeing a lot of that. That may be because of where I am in New York City. It's very, very commercial, and although these days people aren't selling very much art, unfortunately. But I love to go to Europe because I find that the programming, particularly in Berlin, is a very, very high quality, and I always enjoy my trips to Germany. I love the opera there, I love dance there, and I love art there also. I don't mean to denigrate North America too much, but in this particular moment, I'm not seeing a lot of contemporary art that excites me.
Well, since I live in Berlin, I like to hear that you find the Berlin art scene still exciting, because yes, Sometimes there's a lot of negative thoughts right now in Berlin itself, but we'll get to that later. You had a very interesting career. I still have a career as a retired art historian and as a retired museum director, because you ran some museums in North America, in Canada, as well as in the United States. So I just want to go into the beginnings of your interest in art. What sparked your interest in art when you were young?
I was always interested in art. I was always very visually inclined. I like pictures. We didn't have very much art in the family, and my parents were not interested all that much, but I did have an uncle who was a Sunday painter, and he had a store, an Army-Navy surplus store, so he would sell military surplus to miners. I come from a mining town, a city in northern Ontario called Sudbury, and he also had a gallery in the basement of his store, and he showed some Indigenous art, painters like Norval Morisseau, etc. And he was my only relative who encouraged me. We understood each other because we both loved visual art and visual culture, a picture culture, I call it. But I have always been interested in art, and I can't really remember a moment before and a moment after.
Would you also, when you were a kid, would you also draw and paint a lot, or was it more an interest in looking?
Like every child who ever lived, I like to draw and paint. This is something that's quite automatic when you realize this moment that you can represent the world for yourself, even though not everyone's going to understand the picture that you've made. But yes, of course I did that. And I made art, I still do to a certain extent, because I take thousands of photographs a year with my phone, and I try to make good photographs. I try to make them well composed, etc. So it's always been part of my personal life on top of my professional life, and I spend most of my time in museums.
That's a phenomenon I can understand all too well. When I go to a city, I try to go to the museum. It feels like, I mean, my mom, for example, she used to go to department stores and she felt home right there. but for me, I get in a department store, I get immediately overwhelmed and tired. And in a museum, I feel inspired and invigorated. And even, I mean, it could be all kinds of museums, even if it's a museum of some weird object or some Heimatmuseum. I find it interesting to see what is what is shown, because it shows somebody wants to preserve a culture and pick certain objects that symbolize something, that have a meaning. And so even if it's a subject, a maritime museum or something I really don't understand much about. I mean, I didn't even know you call the front of the ship the fore. We're sitting the fore right now. But even a maritime museum can be so interesting just because mm-hmm. the way things are displayed. So do you go to all kinds of museums or mostly art museums?
I do, and I like small local history museums. I became a member of a museum in upstate New York that was a woodmill, and with the family's home, and they're slowly restoring it and everything. And I got very enthusiastic about this place and became a member of it. I like museums, and I like seeing the same artist in different museums because the context changes. You put a Caspar David Friedrich in an American museum, as we know right now. There's the Friedrich exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum. This work feels very different in New York than it does in Berlin or in Frankfurt or in Hamburg. It's a very enriching experience. Unfortunately, you have to travel to see art. It doesn't come to you. And if you're looking at it in a book, you're not having a cultural experience. You're having a sort of secondhand experience. So you have to go to the art. And I really like going to art and being in different places and seeing different kinds of collections, private collections, public collections. All this is something that's very, very meaningful to me, and I think a lot about them when I come home, and I go, why has my opinion about this artist changed? This is, I'm sure it's happened to you. You don't like an artist for your entire life, and then one day you see an exhibition and you say to yourself, I was wrong. She's a genius. Why did I not understand this until now? So context is very, very important.
So you studied art history, and I think in the beginning it was more an interest in the old master.
Actually, my first real great love was Guarino Guarini, a Baroque architect, and I think a misunderstood architect. I was hoping to be the first English language authority on Guarini. And I was also reading a lot about chaos theory at the same time. So I had this crazy idea that Baroque architecture was somehow a prefiguration of chaos theory. Of course, chaos theory is a mathematical theory about modeling turbulence and chaos, etc. And so the complexity of Baroque architecture I found very, very exciting. And I was hoping to do a dissertation and eventually a PhD and become the English language expert on Guarini. And then someone else did it. and I had to find another thing to do. But I also fell in love with German Expressionism at university. I very much like Kirchner, Ernst Ludwig Kirchner. I had a good professor. You know, if you have a good teacher, you can fall in love with just about anything. If they manage to get you to understand the power and the radicality and how the world has changed since this artist, you can find yourself falling in love with something that you would never imagine a million years finding beautiful. But all that closely related. Taste is something that I don't believe in. I think that I think you should be dressed tastefully, of course. You should have the right tie, the right clothes, the right car, the right house. No, I'm exaggerating. But taste is not your friend when you're looking at art. It really interferes with understanding, as far as I'm concerned. If you're looking at art for an aesthetic experience and you're bringing too much of your taste to it, you're not going to have a nice experience. So that's something I also learned by falling in love with Caspar David Friedrich, his paintings. I felt in the beginning very much like Goethe. They're too morbid, they're too melancholic, they're too reactionary. But I had a very good professor then also, and I realized, wait a minute, intellectually this artist is very stimulating. He said he was the iconographer of Protestantism, and that set me off on a whole bunch of reading to try to, I was raised Catholic. I didn't know anything about Protestantism, but Friedrich got me interested, and Protestantism got me interested in Friedrich. So these, you know, there's all of culture is related to all of culture. Isolating the visual arts from music, from history, from literature is not a good idea. You should experience.
Wow, there are so many leads that we could follow now. I want to go back to your word taste. How do you define taste?
Well, taste is very much involved with the Zeitgeist. So something that looked good in 1975 looks ridiculous in 2025, or maybe it doesn't anymore. Things come in and out of fashion. And taste is very, very involved with the zeitgeist. Art, if you let the zeitgeist get too involved, it'll prevent you from liking things from the past and prevent you from understanding and the enriching experience of the past. One of my favorite things to do, and why I like museums that are organized chronologically, is to speed walk through a museum. You're literally time traveling. You're going from one era of human history to another, one culture to another, in just a short walk. You would have to read for months, maybe years, to get the same experience any other way. So I get a little bit annoyed when museums install their works non-chronologically, thematically, perhaps, seeing that the same theme has been going on for centuries. I could have deduced this also in a chronological installation. So yes, I want to imagine what it was like being in this time, the mentality of these people, and what survives, what's permanent in our species. What are the fundamental human values? Art also contains this.
Back to the word taste, because you said fashion, and
yes.
Is fashion and taste are somehow related? Is taste something very personal when you say you shouldn't have taste interfere with looking at art? I mean, I find, for example, when you mentioned Guarini and Kirchner, mm-hmm. I already have some ideas about your taste.
Oh, dear.
Very eccentric.
Even though I told you not to think about taste when you're looking at art.
Maybe that when I say don't think of a pink elephant, you will have a pink elephant in front of you.
Yes, and you can't unsee it.
Definition of taste for me, it's very, I mean, I can't even define it right now, but it's something personal. And I'm very interested in collecting and collections. So I find that collections are formed by a certain taste, because a private collector
yes.
can have, that's great, they can have their own taste rule, other than, let's say, the National Gallery.
But I think the taste is very much involved with also a consensus among people. If you find something beautiful, you saw it on someone who you respect, and you say, well, she's got taste, and it really looks good on her, maybe I should get something similar. You know, taste works by consensus. I don't think it's all that personal. Some people who have a very strong personal taste can look eccentric to the rest of us. They think they look wonderful, they're very inventive, they're very clever. But they're attracting too much attention to themselves because they don't look like anyone else. It's a little bit strange. So there's that element as well. For me, taste is a community thing. It's a consensus thing. But in art, you were talking about looking at work that was from another culture or from another era. Taste gets in the way of your objectivity and really of your personal experience with this object. When you go to a museum, you're not shopping. You're not at the KDV. You know, you're really someplace else, and this should not be a shopping experience. It can be a shopping experience if you go to a commercial gallery, of course. They certainly want you to have a shopping experience. But when you're visiting a museum, it should not be like visiting a department store. You should have a different kind of mentality. When I'm going although I don't buy very much clothes anymore, I'm too old and have lost interest in that long ago. But you know what I mean. It's a different kind of experience, and you have to have different skills in your head. And I usually block my personal taste when I'm in a museum, if that's possible. I try very hard to.
Well, the great thing is, in a museum, you can always be surprised by something that you didn't expect. And
this happens all the time.
Yeah, and that's important that it happens. Mm-hmm. You studied art history, and then you went to New York. You studied in Canada, but then went to New York, and you kind of worked your way up through institutions. Can you say a little bit about your path to the National Gallery? How did that come about?
My first job in the art world, I would think. Well, no, actually, that wasn't my first museum job. No, I worked at the 49th Parallel, which was the Center for Contemporary Canadian Art. The federal government of Canada in the 1980s established a gallery to promote Canadian art in New York, which, of course, is the commercial capital of the art world. It's a very commercial center. It's much less a cultural center than it used to be. And the work I'm doing now in a commercial gallery that's owned by private collectors in Montreal is exactly the same. I'm promoting Canadian art in New York. So there's this wonderful kind of accordion effect of my career, where I'm doing the same thing at the end of my career as I was in the beginning. But I went from that, from small art centers. I was at the Albright Knox Art Gallery and was one of two curators there.
That's a very important museum.
In Buffalo, New York, with a wonderful collection, but we weren't very many staff. I think it's important to work your way up in the museum world. You should not take someone who hasn't got a lot of experience and make them the director of a large museum with three unions and 300 employees. That's very cruel. It's cruel to the employees, and it's cruel to the young person who's got the job. I'm very lucky in that I worked in a small museum, a bigger museum, a medium-sized museum, and then maybe larger, and then very large, and then in Canada, the largest museum. So that seasons you, and you have lots of different kinds of experience, and so you're much quicker on your feet because you've seen this sort of situation before. And that's really my career. I went from small, medium, large museum.
So from Buffalo, you went to Toronto?
Unfortunately, and it is unfortunate because I love art and I love artists, and I wish I could have worked directly with them a lot longer, but I was a curator for only 4 years and then became the director of a Kunsthalle in Toronto called the Power Plant. And then from there, I got hired to the Brooklyn Museum to be the deputy director for art, where I was responsible for the collection, the special exhibitions, the education department, and the libraries, of which there are two.
I want to stay with the Brooklyn Museum of Art because it's just pure chance that I applied to be a curator there at the same time, but I didn't have a work permission, and so there was no chance they would even consider me. But we know, I mean, I interviewed with Buffy Easton, and
yes,
you know her, she was your colleague.
Yes.
And
I was her boss's boss.
Whew. I wanted to be her assistant. No, it's the Brooklyn Museum. It's very big. You probably know much better how many objects there are, but it has a great collection of ancient Egyptian artifacts, and it also has some, to this day, some parts of the museum that you were fundamental in realizing, let's say, the feminist.
We were approached by Elizabeth Sackler, who became a trustee
of not the Sackler family.
It's the same. There's a general fact that she is of the American Sackler. She's the daughter of Arthur M. Sackler, and there's the Sackler wing at the Metropolitan Museum. And the scandal that we know is the British side of the family, the Mortimer Sacklers. She has picketed them and protested that's her cousins. She gave us the gift of Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party, and we set up the Center for Feminist Art that would contain the dinner party and then have exhibition space and dialogue spaces for feminist art. And that was a very important realization, an important achievement.
Basically, I remember like a huge triangular...
The dinner party.
The work, Dinner Party by Judy Chicago. She is probably the most known, most prominent feminist artist living today.
Certainly most popular. She's very, very well known. Her work was shown in the end of the 70s. This is like the Last Supper, except it's in the shape of a triangle, and it's all the famous women in history that we should all know. And they are represented by ceramic plates that are in the shape of a vagina. And they're beautifully embroidered table settings that the plate is on. And it's quite a wonderful work, and it's as popular today as it was in the past. Millions of people have seen this. It traveled all over. Did it go to Germany at all?
I don't know.
It went all over North America. When we opened the center, we opened it with an exhibition of the dinner party, and the critic for the New York Times said, "I don't care if you think this is kitsch. I don't care if it's not to your taste. This is the Mount Rushmore of feminist art." And of course it is. It has this monumental quality in the mind also. But I remember giving tours of it, which was fascinating. So the mother, for whom this is a very important a cultural experience for women, is showing it to her daughter, and her daughter is bored. But her daughter's boyfriend is fascinated. I remember giving a tour to two little boys who were completely enchanted by the embroidery on the dinner party. And I find this so funny. Really, the world is sort of upside down, and then it's getting upside down again. But really, that kind of art is a little bit like a litmus test of our cultural moment and of the zeitgeist also. And
this wing was supposed to be called something different, have a different name?
No, there was a discussion among the trustees that perhaps we should call it the Center for Women's Art. And I told them that women's art is not an art historical designation. This is an art museum. We're like an adjunct to universities. And the art historical term is feminist art. It's feminist not so much in the political sense, although it is that too, but people won't know what you mean in women's art. This is quite specific. And so I was able to convince them that it should be called the Center for Feminist Art, which it is today. Feminist, as you know, is a very loaded term. There are some parts of our political community who think that feminism has been a bad thing for our civilization. I am not one of those people. I think feminism has been a wonderful thing, and the empowerment of women has empowered our whole species. So you won't get an argument against feminism from me.
And a big exhibition that you coordinated and I guess also curated there was the Basquiat show that was quite special. Can you say a little bit about that show? Because Jean-Michel Basquiat is, of course, I think today one of the most expensive painters and the favorite artist of many, many young people and internationally super recognizable. I mean, a very important artist who died very young, but who has left an enormous legacy.
We did his retrospective. Jean-Michel Basquiat was born in Brooklyn to an upper middle class family. His father was a very successful accountant from Haiti. His mother was from Puerto Rico. And his father had a lot of property all over the city. He went to one of the most important private schools. We think of him as marginal. He was never a graffiti artist. He was a graffiti poet. These were texts that he spray painted, and he always knew where the right place to put this text was, because two nights later there would be a one-night big party that all the cool kids would go to, and he happened to know where that party was. It's unfortunate that his prices are so high, because that makes life very difficult for curators and museum directors. I often say that it was easier to learn German than to organize the retrospective for Jean-Michel Basquiat, because there are collectors who dislike each other. There are collectors who collected when he was alive and those who collected when he was dead. They're not fond of each other, and it was very difficult. They don't want to be in the same show with those other collectors. Anyway, I'm glad that's over, but it was a very, very, very successful exhibition. There were about 500,000 people who saw the show. But Basquiat is, I think, he's misunderstood. He's actually, there's a historical change that happened in the art world with Basquiat and also with Keith Haring. These were artists who changed the conversation completely. And a new generation, they opened up possibilities for art that, they're the most fondly remembered artists of their generation. There were a lot of artists from their generation who are now completely forgotten. Because a lot of artists looked at them and said, well, they're rich and famous. I can do that too. That looks easy. Well, it isn't really. The thing that convinced me to do the exhibition, our director Arnold Lehman wanted to do a Basquiat show because he was from Brooklyn, and this was obvious for the Brooklyn Museum. And we were having trouble finding a curator. We didn't have a curator on staff who had the enthusiasm. And I had been very moved by a painting that I saw when I was a student in Montreal. It was called Notary, I remember. And I remember being quite taken by it. It was in an exhibition of recent work from New York. And this was by far the most interesting painting to me. Also, because he was younger than me. I was a student in university, but I was, 3 years older than him. I remember the director being a curator, and there were curators who were willing to do it, but they wanted a huge fee. And then he said, well, why don't you consider doing it? Now, this was not my job to organize exhibitions. I was a manager of the chief curator, the head librarian, and the head of education. But I looked at, he had a catalog raisonné that was done by a French dealer, and I looked at some of his catalogs, and I realized that he never repeated himself, that each painting that he made was a different experiment with color relations, different composition. He didn't have a shtick, as we say. He wasn't in production mode until he started having serious drug problems, and then he did start repeating himself, making merchandise, but that's near the end of his life. He had a short life. He died at 27 of a drug overdose, as you know. But I remember this moment when I realized that this was a very intelligent young artist, and that he was also ambitious. He was ambitious with color and with form, and with expressing his own culture and his own heritage as a Haitian American. And so then I went to the boss's office and I said, I'll do it, because I found that I had something to say.
Do you think it was because of that show that you were pulled away to become the director of the Contemporary Art Museum in Montreal?
No, but well, perhaps, but that show hadn't opened yet. Okay. The show opened after I left, so no, I wouldn't say that. I was just the project director. I wrote one of the essays, and I was very involved in choosing the works. No, they hired me in Montreal because I was a Canadian and a French-Canadian. My background, I'm a Franco-Ontarian, French is my mother tongue, with American museum experience. This is quite unusual in Canada. There aren't a lot of curators or museum directors with American experience, and so that's really why they were interested in me. It happened to be the museum where I fell in love with contemporary art. Imagine you're studying Baroque architecture, and that's your passion, and you start seeing exhibitions in the Museum of Contemporary Art, and you're kind of pulled away there. And so I thought, how wonderful to be the director of the museum where I fell in love with contemporary art. So I couldn't resist that. I had already been now this is a sad story, because my fourth day of work was 9/11. That was quite a traumatic experience for everyone in New York, including me. My former boss in Toronto at the power plant called me up and he said, come home. No questions asked. I said, no, I'm an American now. Because that kind of experience does that to you. But when the headhunter called for the Musée d'Art Contemporain, I had only been in the job for a year, and they said, well, they want a new director, and it's now or never. I said, well, it's going to be never. I'm very, very sad. I want to stay here. I've only been here for a year, and I want to get as much as I can out of this experience. But they called back, and they said, no, the director, who was well past retirement age and had been the director for 20 years, has managed to convince the government that he does not need to retire right away. So maybe we'll call you in a couple of years, which is what they did. They finally got him to retire 2 years later, and then I had been in Brooklyn for 3 years, and by then I was ready to take on a new challenge.
Great. And from there you went to the National Gallery. So,
yes.
But first I want to say one of the shows you did in Montreal was Anselm Kiefer.
Oh.
How did the Canadians like Anselm Kiefer?
It was our most successful exhibition. That had 84,000 people, but that show was up for 4 months. The Kiefer show had 75,000 visitors, which is a big, big number in Montreal. It may not be a big number in larger cities, but it was really very, very successful. I gave interviews on every radio station, TV, etc. It was a beautiful, beautiful exhibition. I loved that show. We had all the famous works. It was really quite extraordinary.
And did Anselm Kiefer come to install it?
No, he did not. But he did send his emissary, someone he's been working with for a long time. I've forgotten his name now temporarily. But this was also an exhibition we'd taken from Texas. He sent a note. He sent a note when he was asked, could he come to Texas? And he said, no, the Americans are murderers, so I cannot go there. That was the note that he sent to the curator. And I thought, oh boy, that's a little harsh. For a German artist to say to an American. But anyway, he didn't come to the United States, and he also didn't come to Montreal. But I did get to meet him, and I went to visit him in Balzac in the south of France. A truly a remarkable artist. Yeah, that in itself was an extraordinary experience. The largest artist studio I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, there's, I don't know if you know the Wim Wenders film was recently. Anselm. It's 3D too, and this huge studio is just overwhelming. And in this movie, you think you're there. Now we are at the National Gallery. You were the director of the National Gallery for 10 years, and you said that the yearly budget for buying new art was $8 million, Canadian dollars. So you spent, in 10 years, that means you spent $80 million on art?
Not myself personally. The curators were much more involved, actually, than I am. That was their responsibility, and also the trustees. It takes a village to run a national gallery. But yes, it was a lot of money. But we didn't just buy new art. We bought some old art also. We bought old masters and photographs from every period, Canadian art, indigenous art. That is a lot of work. That is the most stressful part of running a museum, are the acquisitions, particularly if you're buying old masters. Was this stolen? Is it Nazi war loot? We had done lots of research on a work to make sure that it was not Nazi. And one work that we almost bought had been stolen in the 1960s from a family in Paris. So, of course, we didn't buy that work, and the dealer had to return it because they didn't know either. But our people were really quite clever, and they had figured this out. So, the acquisitions are very stressful. That's what keeps you up at night, because are you buying the right work? Is it authentic? Is it really the right moment to be buying a work from this artist? Or should we wait for a couple of years when she's matured perhaps a little bit? Because this happens. You buy a work and then suddenly her best work is 5 years later. And you have this work that now looks less exciting than the Happy Museum who waited 5 years to buy a work. So this, the special exhibitions are stressful because loans are very, very stressful, and getting loans for particularly for a Van Gogh exhibition. I didn't sleep for 3 months when we had the Van Gogh exhibition, not literally, when that exhibition was up on our walls. But the acquisitions are also very stressful. You're curator, so you have to test your curators. Have you done your research? Tell me again, because if you're not convinced by their argument for acquiring this work, even if you like it, the trustees will not be convinced. Because we're not autonomous. We have there's a budget under which the director is the one who decides. But over a certain price, the acquisitions committee has to decide. And over another price, if it's over $1 million, then the entire board has to agree to acquire this thing. So this requires a certain level of salesmanship, as you can imagine. If you're buying a $3 million old master, that was probably one of the most expensive things. You know, $8 million seems like a lot of money, but you want to make sure that you spend it within the year, because you never know, they may take it back. Governments, as you know, in our wonderful liberal democracies, are very fickle. They change and they have different policies and different ideas. So, yeah.
I don't know a single German museum that can spend $8 million or euros a year on art.
Well, come on, Germany is, and I'm grateful to my predecessor, because he inherited a museum with a $3 million annual budget. Remarkable man who's no longer alive. And he said, it makes more sense for us to have a large amount of money, because we're collecting for the entire country. It was like the lending library for the entire museum system in Canada, because there are no museums that have a budget like that. I think, they will, in Montreal, they'll spend maybe $1 million a year, but they have to go and find that money every year. So we're buying art not for the National Gallery. We were. It's in the past now for me, Mark. I have to keep reminding myself. We're buying for the whole country. And so you have to, we bought things that are of no interest to our collection, but a museum will be very interested in British Columbia, for example, to acquire, should acquire this, even though it doesn't fit in the context of our collection. We don't give it to them, we lend it to them. There's certain objects that are on a long-term loan, they have for multiple years. So it's a very special kind of museum. So it sounds like an awful lot of money, but when you realize you're collecting for the whole country, then you realize it, a lot of my trustees said, should we go and talk to the Prime Minister and get more money? And I said, I'd rather think about it first, because I perhaps need more money for my operating budget than for my acquisition budget, because $8 million is a lot of money, but that's also a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
When you think back of those 10 years at the National Gallery, what do you think could be defined as your legacy? At a different moment, we talked about indigenous art. Is that part of your legacy?
Yes, I would think that's what I'm proudest of. I'm proudest of some of our acquisitions. We bought a fantastic Neo-Rausch that I'm very proud of, things like that. The story of the evolution of colonial art from traditional art to modernism, etc., is different in every colonial country, but essentially the same story. What differentiates Canada from Australia, from New Zealand, from the United States, from Mexico, is the specific story of the contact, the interactions, and the integration, etc., of these European cultures with these specific indigenous cultures that are all different. So that's the story of Canadian art, not the story of the settler communities. It's the story of what happened to the cultures that were already here after this contact, and what happened to these former Europeans, what happened their mentality, their culture, in their interact. This is a very strong influence Indigenous art had on the settler community. So that's the story. So instead of the permanent collection of Canadian art, we broadened it to be the Indigenous and Canadian collection. And this was very difficult because, of course, we didn't have a collection of Indigenous art. My predecessor had established a collection of contemporary Indigenous art from Canada. And what I did was to make that collection international, to have an international collection so that Canadian Indigenous curators could choose work from other Indigenous contemporary artists around the world. And then there's the historical context. A French Canadian has a context of French art at the National Gallery, but an Indigenous contemporary artist does not have a historical context. So we wanted to correct that. And we did. So now Indigenous contemporary artists can have a historical context in this large sort of semi-encyclopedic museum. I'm very, very proud of that. It was very successful. And we also organized, every 5 years, we had the Documenta of Indigenous Art. And that was also very successful, and it's still going on. And this is the contemporary Indigenous art, progressive and new ideas of old cultures. The very first one was extremely moving, and to show you the political effect of art, there was a case before the Supreme Court in Canada, concerning property rights and exploitation of natural resources in land that a group of Indigenous people had said was their traditional land. Well, there's no paperwork to prove that. We had an exhibition of international contemporary Indigenous art. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court came to the exhibition, and I saw her at a cocktail party. And the Chief Justice came up to me, and she said, "I want to talk to you before you leave." So I know we're going to get. And sure enough, she got whisked away, and she did it again. And then finally, as she was leaving, I ran up to her. I said, "I want to make sure you don't leave without talking." She said, "Well, I'm very glad that you have. I saw that exhibition twice." I said, "I happen to know you are one of the busiest people in our country. Why would you see it twice?" She said, "Because I didn't believe my eyes. I had no idea of the progressive, inventive, creative, new, the powerful contribution of Indigenous people from all over the world to contemporary culture. I had no idea." She wrote the ruling that told this company that they had to get the satisfaction of this Indigenous group, and not to come to the federal government to, as you're coming to mommy and daddy, I'm not going to help you. Your job, if you want to exploit this land, is to make sure that the people whose ancestral home this is are happy with the deal. This is their land." So it had an effect, you see, on a very important ruling. It was a historic ruling. It was on the front page and the big headline that the Supreme Court had ruled in the favor of the Indigenous community. That exhibition, I'm convinced, was responsible for it.
If time travel was real, where would you go and to what time period?
I would like to go to Mazar-e-Sharif in the 15th century when they were building the shrine to Ali. They built a beautiful shrine in Mazar-e-Sharif, which is close to Balkh. And I have this fantasy of seeing one of the earliest cities in the world, which is Balkh, and perhaps to expire there. So maybe I'll go when I'm an old man and just lay against the walls of ruined Balkh. It was ruined by the Mongols, and just say goodbye to this wonderful life.
What's your most important tool?
My fingers and my keyboard on my laptop, for sure.
If you were an animal, what animal would it be?
Well, I hate to tell you, dear Lisa, but I am an animal. and so are you. But if I had to be a different animal, I'd probably be a monkey, because in the Chinese astrology, I am a monkey. But also the very mean and naughty children in my primary school when I was very young used to call me monkey because I was skinny and dark and I had big ears. I don't know, I can relate to monkeys because they're the closest to being, I'm quite fond of being this particular animal.
Okay. What game do you like to play?
I don't really play a lot of games.
Do you have a favorite color?
No.
Do you have a recurring dream?
I probably repress it. We all dream of falling. Not really a recurring dream. My dreams are so rich. I hate waking up. It's terrible. I enjoy my dreams far too much.
Do you listen to music when you work?
No, because for me, working is writing, and I need perfect silence. And in my apartment is not very fancy, but I probably will never leave there because it's perfectly silent. No, I don't listen to music when I work. I'm a little bit like Jeff Wall, except I do listen to recorded music, unlike him.
What topic would you like to see in an entire issue of Weltkunst?
Oh, wow. That's a really tough question.
I would say Islamic art, probably.
Well, Islamic art, contemporary Islamic art.
And we should do one on Canadian art, too.
That would be wonderful. Yes, Canadian art, please do. And indigenous contemporary Canadian art.
Can you share a wisdom?
Yes, I had a friend recently who said that he was worried about dying. I said, live your life. Live your life, and it doesn't matter how old you are, live your life, have a life, and enjoy it. I get this from Nietzsche, you know, love your fate. You never know, you may come back another time with eternal recurrence in the Nietzschean system. But I really like this. How does he say? Amor fati.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Lisa.
And thank you all for listening. Der Weltkunst-Podcast wird von Volkswagen Group Culture unterstützt. Dank der Initiative Volkswagen Group Art for All ist der Eintritt jeden Donnerstag von 16 bis 18 Uhr in der Nationalgalerie kostenlos. Aktuell können Besucherinnen und Besucher dort die Ausstellung Dream Together von Yoko Ono erleben. Die Volkswagen Group engagiert sich weltweit für Kunst, Kultur und kulturelle Bildung und fördert zahlreiche kulturelle Organisationen und Initiativen.